G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another instalment of the U Project. Craig Anthony Harper chiming in for episode number, nearly 500. We're nearly 500 deep, Tiff.
I know, we're powering ahead. It's crazy, isn't it?
Look, we do what we can. We're just a little pair of shit kickers. Well, there's three of us down in the fucking Southern Hemisphere just trying to eke out a living and inspire the masses and do what we do. And yes, we're stumbling towards the 500th episode, and we're thinking of doing a very long episode, like 2 or 3 hours, and then slicing it into installments and making it 3-ish or 4-ish 40-minute episodes. So we'll see how we go with that. But if you have any ideas, folks, who you would like on our 500th, because I know you all have opinions, because I keep getting them, that's okay. We want more Dr. Ingrid. We want Jeff Jowett. Anyway, let us know and we'll do that. Joining us today on the U Project is Tara, who doesn't really know how to pronounce her surname. So I'm going with Diversi, or Diversi, or Diversay. That's the French. Hi, Tanya. Hi, Tara. Sorry. Hi, Sally. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Now, the funniest thing, before we went live, I said, is it Diversi? How do you pronounce it? And you went, yeah, whatever you think.
Yeah, I think one of those things coming from Cairns is I'm terrible at pronunciation and enunciation, as I just demonstrated. So when I moved to Sydney, I had to get a speech pathologist to help me. So I don't know how you say my last name. I say Diversi, but I don't mind how anyone says it.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. And I love that. I love that you're so aware of that and you don't care. Who cares though? It's like, I don't care. So what do you do in Cairns? I mean, I know what you do in Cairns, but tell our listeners what you do.
Yeah, I do. I wear a lot of different hats. So I'm a dietitian by trade, very passionate dietitian, and I've got some extra training in behavioral economics and psychology. Mm. Now I'm building a digital health business, Sophus Nutrition and sportsdietitian.com, as my day job. Mm. We're aiming to make health more affordable, accessible and efficient. Mm. And then as well as that, I'm the president of Dietitians Australia, clinical advisor to Veterans Affairs, entrepreneurship facilitator in the Cairns region, and generally contributor. I like contributing.
Wow. So fuck all. You're doing not much at all, let's be honest.
I'm never bored.
When do you sleep?
I don't sleep as much as I should. Number of reasons for that, but I do need to get a bit more sleep, which would be really nice.
I want to open that door. What are some of those reasons that you don't sleep enough? Is it just because you work too much, or do you have a dog that needs a lot of attention?
No, I have a chronic disease called Ehlers-Danlos. It's a pain and hypermobility disorder, so I get a lot of dislocations and things like that. So that's kind of the main reason, and then depending on what I'm doing with my fitness, I also do some weird sports like ice swimming and, you know, try and do running and stuff like that. So depending on what I'm doing, depends on how much pain I'm in, if I'm getting dislocations and stuff like that. And then I also have a little small person who's 6. So sometimes she likes to wake up earlier than I do. But they're the few reasons.
Small people, huh? That's just what they do. Now, tell me a little bit slower, because you do talk quickly like me. What's the name of the condition you have?
It's Ehlers-Danlos, EDS. People
right.
The zebra's condition or spoonies.
Wow. And so your joints are hypermobile. What does that mean? Your ligaments and tendons are kind of lax, or what?
Yeah, so it's a genetic collagen disorder, which basically makes the integrity of the collagen not very good. So that results in a number of different, like the difference in symptoms can vary between people. It's a rare disease, and actually May is the awareness month, although we're in June already. That's how quick life goes. So for me, it's lots of dislocations. I've had 20 surgeries, fatigue, and kind of an overall pain. So kind of like my pain, and everyone's pain is different. My pain is like a fibromyalgia type pain. And then the dislocations is kind of the biggest issue that I have.
So, I mean, I think it's great that the girl with 27 roles and businesses and jobs and a debilitating condition who doesn't sleep enough and has a kid and 20 dislocations, it's good that you just keep taking on more stuff.
Dislocations almost every day, 20 surgeries.
Oh, 20 20 surgeries.
Oh.
Yeah. What?
It's all right though. Like it's not a big deal, but it's not. It's a big deal that I've just learned that I have to design my life around it rather than try and manage it or make it get better. Because there's lots of little treatments, but there isn't really a cure for it yet.
So is there a fair bit of, like, I would imagine there's a fair bit of inflammation?
Yeah, it is a bit different, and it's different for every person, and it does depend on what happens. So when most of my joints dislocate, they go back in unless they do damage, and that's when something happens. So it kind of like it goes in and it goes out. So it's like a sub, and it's probably truthfully most of the time subluxation rather than a true dislocation, but it just goes straight back in. So it doesn't hurt until you kind of do some damage, like until you land on something or someone sits on you to dislocate something. Like one of my friends with EDS sent me a picture and her child sat on her knee and dislocated a kneecap. So that then is a problem. But when you're doing it yourself with your own body, then it just varies between people. Like my symptoms and the things that happen for me is very different to what happens for other people.
And when did you, it's not a dumb question because I don't know the answer. When did you get diagnosed with this?
So I was diagnosed relatively late. I was, as a practicing dietitian, I was at a doctor's meeting and I was just sitting there with my hands doing weird things. And the doctor sitting next to me is like, do you realize your hands aren't meant to do that or your wrists aren't meant to do that? Because basically they kind of go upside down or whatever. And I said, oh, it's normal to me. And he said, you know, you should go and get checked out for this condition. And then asked me a few questions. And so I did. And they said, yeah, you probably have it, but there's no one in Cairns that can look at that. You might have to see someone later down the track. So I've been diagnosed by a couple of different people. One was Dr. Salentz, who was like had done most of the research in Ehlers-Danlos, mostly with kids, and then a geneticist back in Brisbane a few years later, because I was kind of thinking, oh, maybe I don't have it. But it'd be nice if it was a condition that you had that had a cure, but So you just have to learn to accept these things sometimes. And like, I understand that. And part of the reason why I do so much is sometimes you do have that kind of fear of you might only be able to do stuff for a certain period of time. You might end up, you know, in a wheelchair, you might end up with another surgery. So I kind of take every day as an opportunity, or every opportunity as thinking, well, I might not have this for the rest of my life like most people. But in saying that, I have learned to slow down, because now I feel like, yeah, I've done a lot in my life. I can have a bit of a break and not try and achieve so many things. And that's where, you know, I am trying to focus on that digital health business a little bit more. But you just have to design your life around it, because you can't have a normal life. I can't have a normal job, because sometimes I might be injured, or I might have to, you know, have a day off, or might have to sleep in the afternoon. So when I was young, I realized I really have to go into self-employment and I have to work by myself for myself, because you can't always work under the same conditions that you have to when you have a job.
Wow. I love you. You're amazing. I didn't expect this. You're very, I didn't think you wouldn't be, but I thought we'd be talking about dietitian shit. This is much more interesting. This is much more interesting.
Really interesting too.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about the dietitian shit, but you know, you're fascinating. But what I love about you is, I mean, we talk a lot. I mean, pretty much all we talk about on this show is the human experience, you know, improvise, adapt, overcome, create, solve problems. How do I get the most out of me? How do I tap into my potential? You know, what's going on around me? What's going on within me? How do I self-manage optimally, physically, mentally, emotionally? What does that mean? What does success look like for me? And we know that with success, it's different things for different people, as is the self-management process. But what I love is that you've been dealt a bit of a shitty hand, but in the middle of that reality, you're just figuring out the ideal operating system for you, you know, because there's no, as I'm always saying to people, there's no three-step plan. You know, there's the plan that's going to work for you, Tara. There's the plan that'll work for Tiff. There's the one that'll work for me. And there are a million variables around that.
Yeah, and that's what I think. I think for me, you know, and people talk about having unique selling points, but for me it's, you know, having that aligned. Like if you want to do well, I think it has to be aligned to you. When I was a dietitian, well, and I still am a dietitian, but when I was a practicing dietitian, I moved to Sydney. I thought, you know, I'll go into TV, and I did. But one of the things that I had in my head is, oh, I'd love to be like Joanna McMillan Price. And if you've met her, she's amazing, but she's super graceful. And here I am, a bogan from Cairns. And it wasn't until I started to embrace that and go, you know, you're not like her, and that doesn't align for you. And when you look at what aligns for you, then you start to feel comfortable and be able to have success. Because I think if you're having success and it's uncomfortable, it's not as fun. And ultimately, we all want to have a fun life.
And also, success is different things for different people. I just came up with the title of the show, Tiff, by the way, The Bogan Dietitian. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thanks.
Well, it's funny because I'm a bogan too. I grew up in Latrobe Valley, which is a particularly lovely, beautiful, gorgeous, yet bogany area. And I grew up in the most bogany of bogany towns, which is Moe.
Nothing.
I spent a lot of my life.
They're the best.
And I mean, just fucking panel vans and bogans and flannel shirts and moccasins and Ugg boots and super tight jeans. It's just the best, though.
Yes, I'm
just
very
the best.
I find it a compliment.
Now, all right. So let's. What do you do day to day? So you couldn't have, you and I are pretty similar, because I decided when I was 21 or two, I don't want a job. I'm not great at doing bosses. I'm not great at clocking in and clocking out and, you know, putting on a suit and sitting, although let's be honest, I never put on a suit unless I'm doing a gig. And even then I fight violently against that if I can. But, you know, I kind of figured out pretty early that I wanted to work, but I wanted to work for me. So what is work for you now? Like, what's your day to day? And of course it varies with energy and, you know, your medical stuff, but what's your job, in inverted commas?
So I try and spend the majority of my time looking at, you know, we're working on Sophus Nutrition and sportsdietitian.com. And because that's a digital startup, the work there is a little bit different, but it could be anything from sales to content development to looking at our investment plan or anything like that. I do still have some clients that I see individually. Like, we see obviously a lot of clients through our digital platform, but I have a couple of clients. I only do extreme sports and mostly English Channel swimmers, marathon swimmers, ice swimmers. So I've seen around 120 English Channel swimmers, like had the privilege of working with them to get across, or people who are doing something weird, like, you know, walking across Antarctica to South Pole or something like that. Like, I like working with people who are pushing those extremes, and sometimes there's evidence-based, but there's also the context specific that you have to look at that. So I like to be challenged in that way. Mm. I do a fair bit of like speaking and facilitating and things like that around nutrition, but also around performance. So obviously with my psychology background and management background, looking at the things like having difficult conversations or how to persuade your clients or how to, deliver a persuasive presentation, things like that. And then we look at stuff around how we can build out, you know, I'm very passionate about regional Australia and very passionate about the region I live in, which is Far North Queensland. So I'm involved in a couple of organizations here, Launch FNQ, YEP Cairns, and that's about helping people realize what they want to do. So helping people either get into small business or micro businesses, or looking at building a tech startup. You know, I think, you know, building the economic growth in some of our regions is going to help with things like improving health in regions as well. So they're the types of things that I do every day, but it does vary from day to day. I have to block out my time because, like everyone, I get a bit distracted and start doing the things that are the easiest to do or things that I want to do. And because I've got a bit of a team in each of these different areas, it helps work out what can be booked in at certain times and things like that as well. So I do have to kind of chunk my time so that I can focus, because I do like doing lots of things and I do like saying yes. But when I have those boundaries, it allows me to go, well, what do I have to say no to? Because I've filled up too much of that capacity for this month or over this year or whatever that may be.
That's a great question. What do I have to say no to? I talk to people, I still do, but I talk to athletes and people in business and the general public about this idea of an excellence threshold or a performance threshold. And by that, I just mean, whatever the skill or the task or the role is, how much of that can you do really well before the quality turns to shit or you turn to shit? So, you know, I used to employ hundreds of personal trainers. So my question to them would be, how many sessions can you do a day and they all be awesome?
Yeah.
And if the answer was three and then I start to get exhausted, well, then I only want you to do three. you know, or, and I think obviously that number might vary day to day depending on a few other variables, but this is one of the things that I like hearing from you, is that you've got an academic background and you're obviously, you're highly intelligent and qualified and all of those things, which is great. But also you seem to me like a pracademic, right? It's like, you get it. Like, yeah. You seem like you're somebody who's pretty good.
My roommate at Sydney University used to call me a pseudo academic.
Well, I mean,
because it was all about behavior. I was like, I don't care what the site says. Let's look at the behavior. Let's look at how much people will do this for.
But exactly.
He wrote the NRV. So he was very, very smart. And he was smart as anything. But,
yeah, but you know what?
I was like, that's not, I don't find that offensive. I find that a compliment.
But also, you know, intelligence is situation dependent, task dependent, role dependent. If you put me in certain situations, I'm mildly clever. You put me in other situations or environments with other people, I'm a complete fucking idiot, right? It depends on what it is I've got to do. And then we've had many academics on the U project. Most of them have been good, but there's been quite a few, and they're very smart people. They're intellectual, they're well-researched, they're rock solid researchers and academics and lecturers, perhaps, and even authors, academic authors. But you put them in this situation where it's just a general public audience. It's not an academic audience. They're not being assessed. There's no slideshow. There's no graphs. There's no charts. There's no prep. It's just a freestyle conversation. So many of them are out of their depth, because they're not used to just being present and freestyling and talking about their stuff in a digestible way. So
I think it's important to be able to have the permission to have an opinion. And I think sometimes in academia, you don't have the permission to have an opinion or to have your view. And that can be difficult, because you might need to check that if you're having a conversation where you have to say what you think, when you can't rely on what other people think.
Yeah. And I mean, this show is essentially just an amalgamation of opinions. Like, that's the, you know, a few stories and a bit of science. Pardon?
I'm always wrong, but I'm never short to tell you what my opinion is, but always able to give you the warning that I could be wrong, but this is what I think. And I think it strongly.
Oh, that's funny. Well, at least you have good awareness, you know, and you know, I think most of us are wrong pretty often. But I don't think too many people own up to it. So, you know, well done to you. Now, let's jump around a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about, I don't want to talk about your job as a dietitian, because we've had a million dietitians and nutritionists and food gurus. I want to ask you, I want to step back from the minutiae of micros and macros and this strategy or this model versus that model. Fuck all that. What frustrates you about dietetics or nutrition or all the palaver around it? You know, what do you see that you go, that you roll your eyes at? What on a practical and delivery level, perhaps, or even a social or emotional or mental level, do you struggle with when you see stuff happening in and around the food conversation?
There's a couple of things that frustrate me from a few different contexts. So as president of Dietitians Australia, I think that dietitians and actually exercise physiologists are the only two professions that don't champion their profession as the hero. They champion their modality. So you don't hear a pharmacist talking about how amazing medicine is, or how a doctor talks about how amazing, medicine or surgery is. They talk about how amazing doctors are, or pharmacists are, or physiotherapists are. Whereas exercise physiologists talk about how amazing exercise is, and dietitians talk about how amazing nutrition is. So they kind of put the nutrition as the hero, whereas I think the most important thing, and this kind of goes on to my next thing, but the most important thing in nutrition is making sure that it's context specific for the individual, and also that it critically evaluates the evidence, but again, based on that context. So if you're looking at evidence base, so you might have 2,000 people in a study, you look at the middle of the Gaussian curve that says, you know, this works or this doesn't work magically, now this is an evidence base. We always have hyper responders. We always have responders. We always have people who are neutral. But then we have people who are non-responders, and then we have people who are negative responders. So if you look at 2,000 people, you're still going to get probably at least a few people, two or three people, that are those negative responders. So the evidence base doesn't work for them. So the thing that frustrates me is that if I'm sitting in the clinic and, you know, where my studio is now, that's actually where my dietitian clinic used to be. If I'm working with one of those two or three people, they don't care what the evidence base is. It has to be right for them. So I think we need to kind of take a step back and really look at that, you know, look when we get to that stage of intuition, our career journey, and go, well, we know what the evidence is, and we know that this says this, and we know that this says that, and go, this is not right for this individual. How can I make a change for this individual? And one of my very first mentors said to me, you know, and I was frustrated or couldn't get my clients to make changes. And I said to her, you know, what should I do? And she said, Tara, one thing you have to understand is you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And that was probably the first time I took a step back and I thought, you know what? Mentors don't know everything. If people are paying me good money and I can't make them want to drink, then I might need to have to change something about what I'm doing or how I'm delivering the service, because obviously it's not working for them. I can't just say, well, I've told them that and it's up to them. I have to look at what can I modify in my practice or in my delivery or in my communication to make that change real for that client. So really being individual focused is something that, you know, that really drives me. And that's kind of, you know, that's something that's driven me throughout my career. How do I get this right for this one person rather than focusing on mass kind of publications and things like that of what is the actual evidence base? Because evidence base is important, but when you break those studies down, it's not important to that one person that they're a negative responder or a non-responder to that treatment.
I love that. You know, I'm a testament to your thinking, because I was somebody, you know, until I was about, and my listeners know this, but till I was probably about mid-30s, which was obviously about 3 years ago, Tara. I knew how to eat, I knew how to train, I knew how to manage my body, I knew how to optimize my genetics, I knew all of that stuff theoretically, but I always had food issues, never training issues, never, like, you know, sleep, lifestyle, none of that. It was all good. But I always fucked myself up with food. I was a fat little kid when I was young, and then got in shape, then got out of shape, then got in shape, then got out of shape. And that pretty much was a pattern until I was 35. And for me, my food issue was largely emotional and psychological, like understanding the way that I related to food and the way that I told myself stories about food and the way that I managed my behavior and my choices around food and the way that I bullshitted myself. I lied all the time about food. I mean, I would have clients ask me what I eat. I would just lie to them, because if I told them the truth, they'd go, I'm not training with you. You're a fucking fraud. Right. And I didn't want to be, and I wasn't actively trying to deceive people, but I thought if they knew that I went last night and when I got my groceries, I also got a 200 gram bag of Twisties and ate that in the car before I got home, probably not a great PR move.
And I think being kind, and, you know, I used to see a lot of patients who, you know, they had weight on or based on security or based on safety. And I think also looking at labels as well of, you know, in my book, which, you know, is a decade old now, but I've got this chapter called It's Okay to Be Fat. And it's looking at those labels that we have negative connotations around, like bogan, like fat, and knowing maybe you can be these things, but it's okay. It doesn't have to be necessarily negative. Like, maybe it just is a word. It doesn't have to go deep into you. So I think once you start to have some of that acceptance for yourself, one thing that, you know, we know from the research, and you'd know this from your neuroscience, is that, you know, willpower is a limited resource, but love isn't. And I think that is really important for people to understand. So willpower is a limited resource. So if you're trying to put willpower onto yourself, you're going to run out. You're never going to win. But if you love yourself, that's infinite, and you're able to achieve what you want to achieve. So I think that's important for people to understand.
I love that. I've never heard anyone say that, especially not in this conversation. And well, in the same kind of vein, you know, willpower doesn't work, you know, self-control, discipline, motivation, they're all great, but again, they're all kind of short-term, aren't they? You know, and short-term emotions or mental states tend to lead to short-term behaviors, which lead to short-term results. And I put up a post a little bit earlier which is something like, you know, it's about our ability to keep doing what works in the absence of motivation or inspiration. And, you know, it's that, that part of that is loving yourself. And part of that, I guess, is creating a, an operating system that works when you're not in the zone. You know what I mean?
Because you can't always be in the zone. And I think, like, I talk really quickly. I'm a bit intense. And when I'm around intense people, I get exhausted. And I think nobody wants an intense. You don't want to be intense all the time. You don't want to be performing all the time. Mm. And we focus around, you know, why people can't switch off when they're adults. And we're trying to get kids to do all of these educational things. I'm like, just let them have fun. You know, we want to have fun when we're older. So I think, you know, it's just reframing certain things and putting it into perspective. And I do that in my, you know, with my child as well. Sometimes I think, God, I'll just, you know, get her to do this. And, you know, how like they nag at you, mom, 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 mom. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, willpower is, willpower is not limited. Willpower is limited. Love is infinite. You need to keep your ground because you love her and you know that this is the best for her long term. So it's one of those things that I kind of put into all areas of my life, not just food or exercise and things like that.
Well, there's the theory of infinite love and then there's the executing it in real life, Tara, when you're being badgered.
Mom, please, I'll be good.
Do you talk to people about, so I'm fascinated obviously with the mind and with thinking, metacognition, all that stuff. Do you talk to people about their relationship with food and their stories about food and the way that they think about food? Do you talk about that? And if so, how and what?
Yeah, I talk a lot about that. And I also talk about people have short memories. It's like, you know, I was talking to an English channel swimmer before this and, you know, I said to him and he was like, everyone gets really down like in the month before they're crossing, right? Because it's really hard. It's really stressful. They don't know if they're going to like, it's really hard. And I said to him, you know, once you hit France, you're going to touch the sand and you're going to just forget it all ever happened. And he's like, oh, I hope that's true. And I was like, I've seen it time and time again. I can tell you it's true. You'll just be like, oh, it wasn't that hard. It's completely fine. I'll do another one. When can I sign up for the next one? And I think that's the same with food. We kind of look at things, we forget what actually happened and we don't critically analyze what we say. We say things like, if I get to this amount of kilos, I'll be happy. Or if I just do this, you know, I'll be happy. And then I say to them, you know, when's the last time you were at X kilos? Oh, on my wedding day. And what did you think about yourself on that day? Oh, I thought I was fat. And so it's like, well, why are we trying to change the weight when it's actually not the weight? The thought process is still there.
Mm.
Why don't we focus on that thought process and see whether, you know, that makes you happier? Because if you're thinner and they're like, well, I just want to look good on, you know, look good on my wedding day. I'm like, well, Photoshop's awesome these days. So, you know, you can do that easily. So it's having that kind of realistic talk to yourselves. I feel like people are so used to punishing themselves or so used to trying to be different than who they are. Yeah. And I think that sets yourself up for failure because you can't be different to who you are or you can't be somebody else. And I think in the end, it's all about looking at that and then looking at, you know, things like your relationship with yourself. Or is it your relationship with food or is it your relationship with yourself or is it your relationship with your family or is it related to your attachment issues or what is it related to? And then start looking at those from a deeper context because that's where overall food is just one area. And the reason why I'd started to do my psychology degrees was because a lot of people were seeing me because they thought like I was a safer choice than seeing a psychologist, for example. And we do know that food helps mental health. We do know there's evidence around that. But we also know that sometimes by improving your mindset, like you spoke about with your nutrition, or looking at things from a different angle, or having a different focus can actually improve your behavior rather than just focusing on the behavior itself.
Mm. Oh, I love it. There's so much good stuff in what you just said. Do you know a swimmer called Tammy Van Wisser?
I do know Tammy Van. Well, surely her name is pronounced Van Wies.
Well, it depends. Anyway, I used to train her, but some people call her Van Wisser, some of them Van Wies.
Yes.
And her brother, John. I know John. Yep. I didn't train him, but I trained Tammy for quite a while.
They're a phenomenal family. And I think John just did the Duant swim, so just broke the world record on that.
They're both freaks. But, you know, I think one of the things that came out of what you were just saying then to me was it is funny how somebody can look amazing, but they still feel like crap, right? But nonetheless, we still have a story in our head, and the story in our head is, when the number between my toes is X, then I'll be happy. And then we get to X, and of course we're not happy because it's not about the number, it's about something else. Or when I'm size this, or when I look like that, or when I have, we have this ongoing story. And I think, you know, we try and resolve emotional issues with a physical solution, right? And we think, when my body looks or weighs or is like X, whatever X is, then I will have great self-esteem. I'll be happy. I won't overthink anymore. I'll be hugely popular and I'll have no more issues. And I don't, I mean, I think we must all subconsciously know that that's bullshit, but we still have that story. But, and I'm going to get slightly philosophical, but I reckon you're with me. You're with me. Is like our culture is very much externally focused, you know, and about stuff, about things. And success in our culture is primarily about all of the stuff that we can see: your house, your job, your brand, your body, your car, your relationships, your outcomes, your results, what people think of you. And while all of that is, you know, they're variables and they're factors in the human experience, and they're not by themselves, they're not bad, of course. But there's so much emphasis on that and so little emphasis on the internal world, right? And we think that to make the internal world a great place to live, we've got to fix all the external. We've got to address that rather than just going straight to the source sometimes.
And I think potentially doing a lot of different things. I think sometimes people are always looking for the answer, but the answer has got multiple layers into what the answer is. So some of that might be physical, some of that might be spiritual, some of that might be emotional. And there's not just a one answer to what fixes something. And people are always looking for that. What is the one? What is the best thing? And trying to explain, you know, it's maybe a multiple things, and my multiple of things is different to your multiple of things. Mm. And, you know, I'm a scientist, but I swear by like gong meditation is one of my like, you know, ultimate things that I do. And, you know, all of my science friends are like, geez, T, where are you up to now? And I'm just like, well, it stops my brain. It's the only thing that stops my brain. Now, it was probably going to ruin your hearing as well, but we'll cross that bridge when I get to it.
Yeah.
So it's things I think that, you know, you need to look at things as a layer and a continual thing. My mum said to me one day, you know, when I was doing psychology, she's like, Taz, only people with issues do psychology. And I was like, yeah, I've got a shit ton of them. Like, we've all got issues, like, you know. And it's just, you know, in our nutrition practice, we used to kind of look at it like, you know, we've all got issues, and some people wear them on the inside and some people wear them on the outside. And, you know, that's what we need to start looking at is we're not unique and special because we've got things wrong with us or things have happened to us that are bad. That's a part of the human experience. And if we can go back to going, you know, well, I need to work on myself. And what are those things that I can do to work on myself? What are those things that light me up? What are those things that I enjoy doing? What are the things that I'm missing out on? And we align that to where we're going, then we're going to feel better. And I think but it's work.
What are the things that light you up?
Oh, there's a few things that light me up, some in a positive and some in a negative way. I'm definitely a picket holder for when I think someone's been done wrong by. So I think that's what started me in dietetics, being so passionate about being a dietitian. If I felt like a client didn't have the experience with either another dietitian or with a doctor or something, that they really had them as unique. Like if people said, oh no, I don't know what's wrong with you, I'd really go in and kind of doogie house them and try and work out how I could help them. And still now, if someone comes to me with something, how they've been wronged, I want to somehow try and fix that. So I like, you know, the fact of contributing. And that's the kind of the other thing. My life is driven by contribution. I see that, you know, you never know the one time that you're with that one person that you can say that one thing that changes their life. So although I can't obviously help everybody, it's something that I try and do the best I can in the areas that I think I'm going to have the most impact. So that lights me up. And then it just lights me up being able to design my life, to be able to 2009, 2010, I sold my first business and I was like, you know what? I'm never, ever going to go and work in something that I don't want to wake up during the day and be unhappy that I have to go somewhere for work or do something that I don't want to do. So I'm always going to do things that I enjoy doing.
You know what? I think I love that. Well, I'll tell you a quick story about the third person sitting on the screen who started a podcast a year ago and basically threw in the rest of her life and went, I want to be a podcaster.
You.
How many episodes of Roll With The Punches have you done now?
161.
Over how many? Is it 1 year and a week or something?
1 year and a week.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. That's amazing, Tiffany.
Isn't that? Like, she had no idea. She taught herself how to host, how to edit, how to produce, how to manage, how to market, how to do PR, how to get guests, how to get sponsors. Like, and it's so good. It's like people, and well done, Tiff. She knows that I think it's awesome. Like, people are just doing awesome things. And I think that people don't also realize, Tara, some people, how much starting a business and working for yourself is more of a creative process than a business process.
Yeah.
Because you're constantly solving problems. You're constantly figuring shit out. You're constantly interpreting outcomes and data. You're constantly going, well, fucking hell, I'll try this and I'll see what you're rolling the dice. You know, they're educated guesses, but I've been making shit up since I was 26. The last time I had a job, I was 26, you know? And it's yes, there's science in there and there's business and there's methodology and strategy. But more than anything, it's been, you know, a creative journey with, you know, a bit of fun chucked in there.
Yeah, I think with, you know, what I try and encourage people that I talk to that, you know, ask me about different things is I think always stress testing with what's the worst thing that can happen.
Mm.
And, you know, in most of the cases, almost whenever someone poses that question to themselves, the worst thing that can happen is failing or being embarrassed. And, you know, no one's ever died from embarrassment. And I think that's something that, you know, failure, it's again one of those words that we say that that's bad, but failure can be fun as well. It's just a learning exercise. And I think that that's something that if you go, well, the worst thing that can happen is I fail and then I'm embarrassed. I have to tell my friends that my business didn't work, or I have to, you know, sell a little bit of as long as you're not putting things, you've got to look at that risk appetite and have a bit of risk in your life and think, what's the worst that can happen? And usually it's not that bad.
I love that term, risk appetite. Well, the thing is that, as you say, I mean, What's a failure? Well, a failure is literally a label that we give to an experience or a situation or an outcome. And two people can have the exact same experience or outcome or the exact same event or whatever it is, the objective thing. One calls it a lesson, one calls it a failure, and then another one calls it a curious experience. And for each of those people, that label becomes true for them, you know, and it's, I don't know how you went when you started, but when I started speaking, I did about 100 gigs for somewhere between free and $10, and 97 of them were shit. But you can't get good at what you don't do. You know, you can't master
the
thing.
No one's good the first time.
No, but I wasn't good the 50th time. I was average. You know, but you just, like, this is the thing about growth and evolution and mastery. Mastery comes with miles, and mastery comes with pain, and it comes with fuck ups, and it comes with embarrassment, and it comes up with, you know, a million experiences and trial and error. But people want to be brilliant, and people want to be black belts by Wednesday when they start as a white belt on Monday. And it just doesn't happen. Like, there's an unavoidable part of growth and evolution and success and high performance, which is just time.
Mm. And I think having the ability for people are very forgiving when you allow them to forgive you. I think we tend to, like, I talk to a lot of my people who want to become professional speakers or they want to do more speaking gigs. And they often, I say to them, what do you want people to think of you? And they're like, I want them to think that I'm professional. And then I say to them, what do you associate with? Who's the most professional person you know? And they'll tell me, and I'm like, do you like that person? Oh, not really. And it's a really interesting thing. I think, well, why on earth do you want to be seen as professional if you don't like professional people yourself? People want to see people who are real. And so I think, you know, there's always that level of forgiveness. And I, you know, used to say to my PhD, they weren't my students. I was coaching them in presenting. You just tell them, guys, I imagine that you were nervous the day that you were defending your PhD. So I'm just letting you know that I'm a little bit nervous. So for the first 5 minutes, if I go in and out, just pretend I'm online and it's a fuzzy connection. And they're like, oh, that's, you know, so weird to hear. And the amount of time, it just means people just push down and they go, oh yeah, this person's kind of real. And I think having a bit of realness to you is what people like. People like people like them. They don't like people who are better than them. They like people like them. So there's no point in being better than anybody. Just be like normal people. Just be normal.
Mm. And I think when people see your realness and your vulnerability and your flaws and your strengths, then, you know, people relate to you. And if you're up there and you're sharing the most amazing insights and truth and wisdom of all time, but they can't relate to you or they can't get you, then it's hard to have connection, you know? What was the first degree you did?
The first degree I did was Booze and Boys at Griffith University.
No, right. Just... How'd you go in that? How'd you go? Did you get an undergrad in Booze and Boys? Do they just call that Bachelor of Booze and Boys? Is that a BBB?
No, I didn't do that at all. It was actually mostly sport, but I was right into life saving, and I was in the Nutri-Grain series for life saving. So I did mostly that, spent a lot of time at the beach more than the Booze and Boys, but did a Bachelor of Health Science. Right. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And, you know, I think nothing wrong with that. I was 17. I'm glad 17-year-old Tara isn't ruling my life, and then went into dietetics from there. Wanted to be on the Gold Coast, you know, move from Cairns to the beach. So that was my first degree. Second one was dietetics. Then I did my first psychology grad dip, and then I did my MBA. Then I did my postgrad dip in psychology, and then I did my grad cert in education, higher education.
Wow. You're pretty lazy. I mean, really, after this, I want you to go to the room of mirrors and have a good hard look at yourself. Because you're letting everyone down. Wow. No wonder you're tired. No wonder you got bloody a bit of fatigue. It's because you fucking don't stop, woman. Come on. What are you doing?
I do stop. I have lots of free time nowadays. In my 20s, I worked really, really hard. But 20s and, you know, I feel like from when I was 35, it's been a bit more relaxed and focused on what I enjoy doing and where I can have the most impact.
Mm. Now, this is a philosophical question about philosophy, so get ready.
So Break myself.
Okay, well, all right, so let me preface it to give you an idea of where I'm going. So when people say to me, what do you do? Like my job, it's really broad and I could talk for 30 minutes and bore them. But I generally say I help people change stuff, right? And then that opens, you know, what stuff and where and with who and what groups and individuals, and then we can talk about whatever. So one, what's your elevator pitch when people go, Tara, what do you do? What's the elevator? What's the 50 word kind of summary?
Well, it depends, context specific. If it's a dietitian related, I'm a dietitian by trade, proud but dietitian. And I run a digital health company, Surface Nutrition and sportsdietitian.com. But sometimes people know me through something different. Like they might know me through ice swimming, or they may know me through entrepreneurship, or they might know me through innovation or as a speaker. So it really depends on who I'm talking to. But I always do struggle with that question. And I've tried a number of different ways, but it doesn't tend to work. So I wear a lot of hats. I do lots of things, those types of things. People say I look young for my age sometimes. So they kind of go, oh, I don't, you know, are you sure you've done all of that? But yeah, I do struggle with that all the time, because I think, you know, evidence tells you, or what people tell you, is if you focus on one area, you can be super expert and super successful. But to me, success is around enjoying your life. And I enjoy doing different things. I enjoy having multiple income streams, and so I'm just going to keep doing that.
Yeah, awesome. All right, now I can't let you go without you telling us about ice swimming, which just from the outset I'm going to say seems like a really bad idea.
Dumb. It's quite a dumb idea, and I didn't talk about it for a little while after I did it, because I had done quite a bit of damage to my body. But yeah, it's an intense sport, and there was some stuff that I was going through and I wanted to get rid of. And I was reading a book from The Body Keeps Score. And you know, I've always been interested in like how physical, how psychological issues or trauma have been manifested in physical bodies. So I've read a lot of those types of books and was really interested in that. And so I read that again, and it was going through a few different strategies. And his belief, Bessel's belief, was there's three ways to cure trauma. One is through medication, two is through talk therapy, and three is through doing something that almost kills you. And my friend was, you know, had done an ice swim and in December, and I'd always said, nah, I'd never do that. Nah, I'd never do that. Never do that. And then I saw these pictures of him swimming in Antarctica, and I was like, 100%, I'm in. And I said to him, I want to do that. And he's like, we have to do an ice mile first. And no one in Australia, no female has done one. So maybe you should give it a go. And I was like, yeah, I'll think about it.
Hang on. So many questions. Okay. Hang on. You can't just go, I'm going to do an ice mile. Okay.
Yeah,
hang on. Where the fuck do you do an ice mile? What does that mean? Does that mean swimming nonstop? Does that mean just surviving? Is it?
Well, yeah, it's one of the only sports. So you have to swim nonstop in, you know, just your togs. You can have a swimming cap, earplugs, and goggles. You have to swim nonstop, water less than 5 degrees, a mile. You have to do a kilometer prior to the mile and then get an ECG and wait a couple of weeks, which we didn't do. We actually did our qualify the day before our full
Of course you did.
And then we did a mile in less than 5 degrees, and then you have to be alive 45 minutes after you finish.
You have to be alive.
To count, if you get it right.
Yeah, no, I think it's always, what about poor Brian? He died at 43 minutes. Fuck, we can't give it to him.
He's out. We'll have a funeral for him, but he's out. No. So I wouldn't recommend this. And this is something that was a bit dumb, Tara. Like sometimes there's things that I'm like, that's a bit dumb too. And doing the ice mile with only 6 weeks training was hard. But because I worked for myself, it meant that I could kind of put in some time, and I had to put in time. So I got a freezer on my balcony in Cairns and set one freezer at 2 degrees, one freezer at 0 degrees, and just started doing similar to Wim Hof breathing, but not exactly Wim Hof breathing. Did some psychology training, did some the ice baths. So did ice baths twice a day, and then signed up with a kids swimming club to try and get fast, because obviously the less time you're in the water, the better. So we did it in Thredbo. So like cracking, we did the qualifier in Thredbo, and then the water was too frozen the next day. So we had to go to Krakenback. So we went to Lake Krakenback to do the mile attempt.
Oh my goodness. Now I don't want to open the door on that. Fuck. I was going to wind up. I don't want to wind up now. I want to keep going. I was just stumbling like a piss bloke towards the finish line. And then you open this new exciting door. Now I'm fucking reinvigorated. Do you have 5 more minutes?
I've got 5 minutes. Yep.
Okay. So I don't want to know what the trauma was, but did it help?
100%. So the next, like, so there was something that happened, and then I'd get triggered by like text messages and things like that. And I could just get them, and it still was upsetting, but it didn't immobilize me. And
what's the mechanism? Why is that? Tell us, explain, like, you're a psychologist and an exercise physiologist of sorts.
Not an exercise physiologist.
Well, you did health science, close enough. Then you did diet. You're smart. Tell us how it works.
I think to the point of, you get to the point where if you do something as bigger than you, so when I ran a marathon, when I swam the English Channel, where like I've done a lot of things, when I did my uni degrees, I always knew that I would come out of those, because I've got a way of hacking through things if I don't have the skills or knowledge, like I have a way. And so I knew I would always be able to do those. But one thing, when I swam English Channel and I swam, you know, Gibraltar Strait and Palm Beach to Manly. So I did these big swims, but I never thought, oh, this is hard. Like I thought, yeah, I'm okay. It was hard, but obviously it wasn't out of my reach. Whereas I think this was something that was so far out of my reach that I didn't think I would do. And even to the point of the whole way that I was doing it, like when I was halfway, White's like, you're halfway. And I was thinking, I'm not going to finish this. Why is he yelling that out? I didn't think I'd die, but I didn't think I'd make it. And I think it's kind of getting to the point of going, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And that's where I think the ice mile for me was curative in that way. It was something that I still, you know, had to do. you know, had to do work and things like that on myself. But the Ice Mile was one of those things where, you know, I had a problem, I did that. And then because it was bigger than me and I achieved it, I kind of realized that, you know, these things can't break you. You're going to be okay.
Can you tell us, you're a complete weirdo, but I'm just very inspired, like an inspirational weirdo. Like I love
inspired
that.
Inspired enough to go and do an ice mile.
Yeah, I'm not that inspired. No, a lovable weirdo. I love it. That's a compliment.
I take everything as a compliment.
Can you remember, I mean, as in, can you remember what it was like? Maybe it's indelibly etched in your brain and your cells, but can you remember being in the water? What's your most, other than fuck, I can't make it, what's your most vivid recollection of that actual experience?
So
was it just overwhelming pain, or was it something else? So
it basically feels like you go into pain almost through, like it's like sister, like almost like your legs, like you, it's like pain, oh, and then it's like it gets chopped off and then it becomes like completely numb and like ice, pain, chop off, ice. So the biggest, scariest thing in the kilometer was when I couldn't work out whether my mouth was opened or closed and I swallowed some water. So that was the, like I was swimming and then it was like, and I got water in my, and I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And so I hadn't really thought about that because everything else I'd kind of trained for. I'd had my head under the water in the freezer. I'd watched some videos, but I just didn't think about that. So that was the hardest thing of the ice kilometer. And then the next day, because that water was about 2.5, like between 2 and 2.5 degrees. So it was super duper cold. And so I remember that. I remember finishing and saying, I'm never doing this again. I'm not doing the mile. So I remember that. And then the next day, so that was a bit scary. And then I realized if I breathed forward, then I could keep, I could make sure I can see when my mouth is above the water because you couldn't feel it because everything was numb. So that was the recollection in the kilometer. And then in the mile, same thing, everything going numb. But then one thing I didn't expect was basically my lungs not being able to feel if I was breathing. But I knew I was breathing, and one of the things that I'd practice is breath holding. So I knew I could hold my breath for kind of 3 or 4 minutes. So I was like, well, how long is it going to take me to do these 2 laps? Will I be okay? But I couldn't feel that I was breathing, but I could hear. And, you know, my wonderful friends, like, they're like, gosh, you sounded like a walrus. And I'm like, thank God I did, because at least then I knew that I was breathing, because didn't help that for kind of a few months after that I'd be doing when I was in meetings and things like that, because it took a while for my lungs to restore themselves. Like it's one of those things that I am very proud of, but I'm also very aware of that it was probably the dumbest thing I've done.
Tara.
Yes.
Admirable and stupid. Tara, how long did it take you to fully recover from that?
About 4 months. Four months until, so they think that I had, they're not really sure, but they think it was like that my lungs were kind of frostbitten. Mm. So it felt like I had pneumonia for about 4 months. And I'd do this, you know, like the old man, like in meetings, and you wouldn't even notice you're doing it. And you like look at them and you're like, I don't think they know that they're doing that. That's what I was doing for about 4 months.
I do that in meetings all the time. That's pretty much my go-to. Probably one last question, but who the fuck knows with me? I have no rules and I have no plan. My temporary last question is, did you gain body fat for that swim?
Yeah, I put on, I was probably 5 kilos heavier than I wanted to be anyway. And I do put that down to part of the protection around the kind of trauma stuff that I had. And then I put on another 5 kilos. I ate these, they were delicious. Like I really enjoyed this, like 2 tortillas with cheese in it. And so I ate a couple of those a day. And then I did obviously my sports nutrition stuff. So yeah, I put on about 5 kilos for the ice swim, bit of bioprene.
It's isn't it funny when you do a sport, the only other one that springs to mind for me is sumo. when you do a sport where to compete, it's advantageous to have a higher body fat percentage.
Yeah, and that's like a lot of our English Channel swimmers, and it's interesting. It's for some of them, it's harder for them to put on weight than it is for people to lose weight. But we also have to work out, you know, there's a whole bunch of things we have to work out because we're getting people who are older and older, higher risks of things like chronic diseases. So we want to put on weight, but also with performance athletes, we want to make their accessibility to carbohydrate or their ability to absorb carbohydrate better, but we don't potentially want that in our, you know, people who are over 50, potential of chronic diseases. So we want to try and work out what's the minimum kind of weight we have to put on with the speed they go and how they swim and all of those types of things. So it's really, it's individualized and difficult, but it means that they are more likely to get across but not become hypothermic, or they kind of become a bit hypothermic but not death-defying hypothermic.
Such a rare sport that you've actually got to gain body fat to improve performance.
Yep.
Yeah, amazing. Now, all right, tell us about your businesses and how people can jump online and see what you're doing and get involved.
Yeah, so with Sophus Nutrition and sportsdietitian.com, at the moment we actually have been lucky enough to get a couple of grants from the Queensland government. Doesn't help that you've got a national audience, but if you're in Queensland, we have a free corporate nutrition program through our app and Queensland sporting teams, free sporting programs for sporting teams here as well. So Sophus Nutrition and sportsdietitian.com, they're our companies.
Perfect. And it might, you might like to know that our second biggest audience in Australia is actually Queensland. So it goes Victoria, Queensland.
But New I bet South. They're the most fun.
What's that?
If you surveyed them, they'd be definitely the most fun.
Hey, come on. Victoria's definitely the winner. Oh, we go off in lockdown. Fucking hell. It's just one big party down here. And by the way, no one's angry at all.
Nobody hates Queenslanders right now.
Yeah. Sorry, God. Hey, Tara, thank you so much for being on the You Project. You're a hoot. We really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your story and your thoughts and your wisdom and your insight. And, you know, let's do it again.
Awesome. Have a wonderful day. And thanks so much for having me. Nice to meet you both.
Thank you. Stay on the call if you would for a sec, Tara. Thanks, Tiff. Good get by you.
Thanks, Tara. Thanks, Harps. That was awesome. That was really awesome.
That was, you know what happens, the first thing that we do, just keep rolling, Tiff, people can hear this, people can hear this. The first thing that I do, whether it's Melissa or Tiff, is we generally get off a call and then I go, what did you think? And I know that she's going to go, she was ace. So, yeah.
It was one of those ones where as soon as Tara started speaking, I feel like you and I both went inside our heads, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah, so we went, oh, sigh of relief, because that's not always the case. It usually is.
Boring people from Cairns. Too much right. Up there.
All right, let me sign off to the group and then we'll say goodbye to you, Tara. So thanks, team. Appreciate you getting involved again. If you enjoy the show, tell 1,000 of your closest friends, will you? Love you, guts. See you next time.